Well, good day and welcome back to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. This is part two of a two-part episode. We started off last week with Dr. Nick, Dr. Dan, of course, our own Dr. Joe Holly and Sam Bradley here on the show. We were talking about some of their experiences responding to various disaster situations with the Ohio Task Force team for USAR, and they were working on talking about that. We now segue into talking a little bit about some additional topics to carry on that discussion even further. So let's go on in, and without further ado, jump on into part two of this two-part episode talking about disaster and how people can prepare and be better organized for when the major events happen in their communities, as based on the experiences of these two doctors coming to us from Ohio State University. So let's check that out, and we'll get into that right now.
Dan, you had a really interesting story out of Hurricane Matthew. You want to tell us about that one?
Yeah, I'd love to share this story. So, again, Hurricane Matthew was October 2016, and Ohio Task Force was one of the many FEMA teams that were activated and mobilized in response. And the story that I'm going to share with you was it was chronicled in the Washington Post by a reporter named Travis Andrews. But, you know, I have some firsthand experience because our team was one of the players or one of the characters in this story. And the story really is a conglomeration of where our system and our society even is with not just social media, but technology and the large disaster network that is at play in these big events like Hurricane Matthew was. So the scenario is lots of flooding in throughout the state of North Carolina, which was where our team was working, and it so happened that there was a person, he's a military veteran who was living by himself in a house, and floodwater started to surround his house, and he lost cell service. So he was not able to call 911, but he still had data service. So he was able to interface with things like Facebook Messenger and Twitter. So he was interacting somewhat with his brother, who was in Texas. So, you know, many miles away, states away. And as the flooding progressed, the first floor of his house was essentially totally flooded out, to the point that he was stranded and sequestered in his attic. And again, he had a dog with him that had some medical problems, and with the two of them were not able to rescue themselves, essentially. They tried getting into the 911 system using their data. Again, the cell service was down, but they were unsuccessful with that. And so this guy's brother in Texas was trying to help him also trying to, you know, alert people. And he posted something on Twitter and was also scrolling through Twitter. Well, so while this is playing out, there was a third player in this who has a drone, just a private person, not, you know, associated with, you know, any group in particular, but, you know, has this drone and was flying the drone around the neighborhoods. And this person was also very active on Twitter and Instagram. So he was uploading photos from his drone to his Twitter and Instagram handles with hashtags from this town, Hope Mills, North Carolina. And so the guy in Texas, again, the person who stranded his brother in Texas, sees some of these photos, and he sends one of the photos to his brother, the one who's stranded, with not realizing that it's a photo of his house, but, you know, with a comment saying something sarcastic, like, you know, well, it may be bad, but at least it's not as bad as this neighborhood is. And the guy, the guy who's stranded with his dog, replies back to his brother. He's like, that's my house on the, you know, far side of that photo. And I think there were some expletives, you know, in there, which I'll keep out at this point. But anyway, so now this person in Texas, through social media, through Twitter, gets in touch with the person who's operating the drone in North Carolina. And that's when our team comes into play. So the drone operator, he was going to try to make a rescue, but it just so happened that one of our boats, with our rescue technicians, was going by, and he used his drone to get their attention, and then used the drone to lead the boat to the house where this gentleman and his dog were stranded. And there's video footage of the rescue happening, you know, our boat pulling up to the house, and then, you know, them getting the person and his dog, and then getting them to safety. So you know, really, just kind of an amazing story when you really think of the chances of, you know, someone, you know, operating a drone, sending pictures over social media, and then, you know, just all those things coming together to make for a real success story. So.
You just can't make this stuff up. I mean, like you said, all the elements of this are just insane. You sent me a link to the Washington Post story, so I think Jamie can post that if people really want to see what was going on with that story. And as well, getting back to Nick, you had sent me a little video on the nursing home rescue, and I, too, was really impressed with those vests because I've never seen a nursing home do that. So it's nice to know that people are being proactive. Joe, thoughts?
Wow. I mean, what an incredible story that is. I had not heard that before. I was not aware of all the intricacies involved in that story. And it is amazing on so many levels. And I think, you know, in many cases, it shows how far we've come on social media and the potential for social media to impact our ability to gain intelligence on the situation that we're involved in from a USAR standpoint and, you know, hopefully to utilize that. I think a lot of what USAR needs to work on is our ability to plug in to all of those different data streams, whether they be social media or more standardized, you know, data streams related to news or GPS or, you know, fire department or whatever. To me, it's eye-opening about how much potential we have, and I think we have to find a way to have to find ways to really make those systems work in our favor and let people know that these systems are available and how they can reach out to response assets to say, hey, I got a drone flying, I'm seeing this, I need you guys there so that we can take advantage of all of that amazing technology information and data that's out there floating around. So kudos to you guys. What an incredible story that is.
Jamie, you had a thought?
Well, I thought of two things. We've had somebody on recently on the show talking about how drones could be used to actually map disaster situations in real time, in high definition and high fidelity for location mapping. And the other side of that is Kyle has talked before about the very nature of social media allows for someone at quite a distance to actually work in tandem with people on location to act as someone who collates and screens information coming in over social media to try to weed out and get down into the calls that seem most needy at the time, or prioritizing things, so to speak. And he's talked about groups that have organized in other countries even to monitor hashtags and stuff in social media disaster situations, you know, thousands of kilometers away, and then relay that information to local people who are monitoring their feed to get information that's been scrubbed somewhat. And I think that you know, there's some potential in both those things to try to, as Joe said, and as Nick and Dan have both said, to kind of get that information to a point where it's useful and there's less likelihood of a false positive.
Nick, your thoughts?
No, I've heard Dan tell that story before, and it still blows me away when I hear about it. And I think, you know, we've always been using remote technology, you know, robot type technology to get information from places where we can't get in. And so I think drones, there's huge potential there. The other thing that I saw recently is telemedicine as a way to see and assess patients. So, you know, if you had a patient that was in the rubble pile or trapped in an attic, you know, and they still had, you know, mobile technology or service, you could actually see that patient, give them some advice. So it's incredible. And I think it's going to keep changing so quickly that it behooves us just to know what's out there and how to, or at least know people that are going to be with us that can access this type of information, because there's a lot to it. I agree.
Well, you guys also brought up a couple of multiple part questions that maybe we can kind of share these. The first being challenges specific to hurricane response, which include hazards of flood water, communications, predicting impact, and how to stage resources. So, Nick, you want to take a crack at one of those?
Yeah, I mean, I think Dan and I talked about this not long ago. A lot of the FEMA USAR teams do a lot of training on earthquake response. And it seems like lately we've been deploying to hurricanes associated with a lot of flooding. So I think Dan and I had talked a lot about getting more training on boats training. And Dan, of course, has a Navy background that helps him with that. But I think what I've seen the USAR teams do, and Joe knows way more about this than I do, is sending multiple smaller boat teams to these disasters and, you know, still having some larger teams there that have a physician with them that can help take care of those teams. But I would surmise that a type one task force that would have 80 plus people and equipment to support that amount of folks, you know, that's a hard thing to put in flood water. So, you know, one thing I saw, at least in Houston, was sending smaller, what we call mission-ready packages, or MRPs, to go to these disasters with their boats, and they don't have all the other stuff, so they can be a little bit more nimble. But I think the issue that comes along with that is you have to have enough teams for them to attach into that they can have the resources they need to function in a disaster. So I guess those are just observations. They're not answers, but I'm interested to see how the FEMA USAR teams attack these hurricanes, you know, moving forward with the observations that I've seen.
Joe?
Thanks, Sam. I think Nick has brought up some awesome points, and they have certainly been issues that are under discussion. I think part of this has to do with our, these sort of mission-ready packages that we have in the USAR system now. I'm not sure that we have yet reached the stage where we are utilizing them most effectively, and we have put together systems that have made certain that we're addressing all the issues related to them. So, as Nick sort of alluded to, there are issues with medical care to a mission ready package that might have one medic or two medics attached to it, and things like who's the medical control for that medic, and who's he supposed to reach out to, his doc at home or the doc of the type one task force that's close by, or the IST doc or whatever. And I think we're still sort of working through many of those issues. And I think at the same time, we have not yet matured very well. We're still maturing, maybe that's a better way to say it, in our ability to incorporate, utilize, and maximize the benefit of social media and issues related to all these stories that we've heard, right? Everything from, I got a drone seeing a guy and I need somebody to come help him. How do I connect with the right people to do that? So I think we're in a time of very rapid change in the way we do business and very rapid change in the tools by which we do our business. And so we're, it's a big cumbersome system like all, governmental issues. I mean, it's a bureaucracy that takes some time to move. And as frustrating as that can be, it's just the nature of the beast to some extent. So, it is incumbent upon, the search and rescue system as it is currently laid out at every level from local to regional to state to federal to aggressively be pursuing all of these new methodologies by which we can be tasked, we can receive information, we can assess the quality of that information, we can, as Nick beautifully pointed out, talk about the ability to assess a patient via telemedicine from a drone in their attic while they're stuck. I mean, that's an amazing idea and concept that I think that has great potential for USAR, but, requires a lot of infrastructure and requires the people who understand that infrastructure and how to utilize it and how to maximize its benefit. So, there's just a lot of moving pieces right now, and that makes it somewhat challenging and equally frustrating. But I think at the same time, it makes it very exciting as we push forward to figure out the best ways to utilize lots of new technologies that are all seem to be coming online at the same time.
Yes, it's truly fascinating. Dan, your thoughts on that?
I think, Joe, you articulated that very well. And, I'll emphasize one of the things that you said, which is that this is a very dynamic time. for the USAR system. And that's not just FEMA. I think, you know, that's something worldwide, you know, that we're seeing, you know, with that whole industry, if you will. And back to some of the challenges specific to hurricanes. One of the challenges that always exist, but I think is especially poignant with hurricanes, is your distribution of resources, especially when you're dealing with something like Hurricane Florence, which was, again, just in 2018. But that was a hurricane that at times covered 4 to 5 states. You know, it had a footprint larger than a lot of, you know, countries in Europe. So trying to determine, you know, where to stage your resources can be really difficult. But this discussion about moving to mission-ready packages and, you know, looking at, you know, different ways of dividing up your resources, I think has allowed us to continue to adapt and be even more nimble for what these events represent.
Well, DMET's doing a lot of that these days too, having task forces, they call them, or specialized teams doing specialized things instead of always the big, large team. So that seems to make a lot of sense. So lastly, you mentioned challenges to assisting persons during a hurricane and why there is such a high evacuation refusal rate. I'd like to hear about that one. Nick, you want to start with that one?
Yeah, I guess I will. I think I didn't experience this quite as much as I think in talking to Dan he did. I know in the past when rescuers weren't willing to take a victim with their pet or their belongings, they were reluctant to leave. And I have to say that I think we've done a good job of allowing people to bring their pet. I don't recall the exact number, but we did something close to 50 animal rescues when we were at Hurricane Harvey. And I very clearly remember most families coming out of a house with a pet, a cat or a dog, and us getting these people into the boat with other families, and the dogs would be yapping at each other. And so I think people think by human nature that the disaster is not going to happen to them and they don't want to evacuate. And it is a problem because then, you know, it puts the responders in harm's way. But we didn't see a lot of folks refusing to kind of evacuate once we got down there. I think just because of the sheer damage that was done. But Dan, you probably have different experience than I do on that.
Thanks, Nick. Yeah, you know, I think that the domestic animals piece is probably one of the biggest barriers to effective evacuation. You know, within the FEMA system, you know, we don't have a mission objective necessarily to, you know, to save animals, but at the same time, you know, we recognize exactly what you said, Nick. And, you know, for that reason, you know, if it's, you know, safe to, allow animals to be evacuated or rescued, you know, along with their owners, then, you know, that's something that we usually try to do. You know, I think some of the other barriers, you know, rely around some of the education of the public regarding what happens when they evacuate. You know, many people don't have means to evacuate to somewhere. And it's not just about getting them out of the harmful environment that they're in, but they don't know what the resources or options are once they've left that environment, and that can be very scary. So I think a lot of, you know, what I've seen our team do is try to provide some of that education to the people that we interact with. And it doesn't always take on the first presentation. You know, I know we had multiple locations where we effected rescues, and it was maybe the second or third time that we had been there, with the first time, you know, them declining the rescue. But as things got worse, and, you know, we went back to do a safety check on them, they started to understand more of the process and the resources. And so again, so, you know, I think that education takes time. I'm not sure if there's a way to necessarily do that prior to these events happening, but you know, we do our best to keep the victims informed and try to keep them aware of, you know, what's happening, and just give them the best information to make the best decision. So
Joe, we've had quite a few discussions about animals. You want to come in on any of the above here?
Well, I think that was beautifully said. You know, it is a real challenge. There's no question that folks are reluctant to, they're certainly reluctant to leave their pets and domestic animals otherwise. I think in many cases, they're reluctant to leave their property. I'm sure they worry about where am I going to go, what's going to happen, and, you know, issues like looting, and I'm not at home, and people are going to find me, and I don't have access to my stuff. I mean, you know, there's a million different reasons related to that. And I think we heard a very well thought out and well-rounded discussion about all of those issues. So I think it's part of what USAR has to do to make certain that people have a good understanding of that. I think we will always face issues where, in many cases, we have to make two and three attempts before we can convince people of what they need to do. And I think that's just a lack of experience on the part of the folks that are under threat from whatever the disaster is. And having never experienced that before, they have a real difficult time appreciating the relevance of what it is we're saying to them. And as was pointed out earlier, you know, it can't happen to me, and it can't be that bad. And, you know, I'll just I've been through a bunch of hurricanes, and they're all fine, and I'll be fine again until I'm not. You know, it's just the nature of people, and it's the nature of disaster medicine in many cases. And so I think what the system needs to do is to be prepared and to understand that those issues are going to be present, and we're going to have to deal with them, and we may have to deal with them two and three times before we get the result that we hope, and that we have to go into those situations planning for two and three times, you know, what we thought we'd have to do to get the job done. So it's just part of the planning process on the part of those of us who are responders to major natural and man-made disasters all across the world.
Well, lastly, guys, speaking of education, I'm really intrigued with your session for disaster educators. And you're also talking about how community resources can be used there to, and creating educational events at hospitals hospitals and other things. So, Nick, your thoughts on that? What would you like to say about it?
Yeah, so I think I don't think we're the only ones doing this, but I think once you live in a community for a fair amount of time and you kind of learn who the players are when it comes to emergency preparedness and disaster response, you're able to foster relationships that allow you to give learners opportunities to learn things that they wouldn't otherwise get. So I'll give you a few examples. Dan and I sit on some disaster preparedness regional committees, and the other folks that are at those committees have, interesting talents or abilities. One example is the National Guard 52nd Civil Support, which is the WMD team for the state of Ohio, comes to those meetings. And, you know, we got in a conversation with them, and now they lead a session for the disaster elective that Dan is the instructor for. So we also allow our medical students and residents to take part in the large-scale disaster drills that happen in our region. So John Glenn Airport is obligated to have a disaster drill every year. So we marshal our medical students and residents, and we allow them to participate. And I think it gives them an opportunity to experience these things before they actually happen. And just as an aside, we had a armed aggressor event on Ohio State campus, a guy who drove a car into a group of college students and then got out of the car with a machete. And we wound up seeing a surge of patients that day. And I can tell you that it felt a lot like one of the drills that we had done with our residents and our students. So I'll let Dan expand on it a little bit more, but I think the gist of it is these drills and exercises and events are going on in almost every community. And if you can learn, you know, where they're happening, you can bring your residents, your medics, your medic students, your medical students all over and let them experience this so they know what to do when the real thing happens.
Thanks, Nick. Yeah, you know, I think you really articulated the design of our disaster educational efforts really well. One of the other things that I might add is just the utilization of some of the free or low-cost resources that are out there. Some of the fallout from some of the bigger disasters that have happened in the last couple decades, like Hurricane Katrina, the 9/11, events, is that there has been more allocation from a federal, from a high level, trickling down even to the regional levels of resources. And that includes things like online modules or local courses. Oftentimes these courses, like the local courses, are coordinated through your county emergency management agency. And again, most are, or if not all of these are free. Again, the online resources through FEMA's training website. There's a ton of good resources there. So just, tapping into those things that already exist is relatively easy. You know, it's just a matter of carving out that time and making your audience aware. I think we could probably do a whole session just on the educational side of disaster medicine. We didn't even really touch much on simulation. That's a big component of what we use for disaster medicine, and that's not unique to disaster medicine. Obviously, I mean that's used in a lot of different scenarios, even outside of medicine. That's might have to have another whole session just on, education and disaster medicine, Joe.
You read my mind. I was thinking exactly that. And there's clearly plenty to talk about there. We can easily get probably a 2 podcasts out of that. So, yeah, we definitely need to plan another podcast to have you guys on and talk about the educational piece of all this.
You know, I completely
would love to do that.
Yeah, I completely agree, Joe. And you know, as I was thinking, you know, listening to both Nick and Dan talk about the ways that preparedness and these type of training drills that go on in so many places near to a lot of organizations, they just need to kind of connect in with them and reach out and say, we'd like to participate, or send someone to participate so that they can bring back what they've learned. It made me think of so many of the things you guys are doing with your organization at Paragon Medical Education Group, and when you guys are preparing cadaver labs and things like that, so that people can get some real time in a situation where they don't often get access to real tissue and to experiment and see what works and what doesn't work with different types of treatments in extreme situations, and then going and taking that experience and going back in. I know that's something you guys strive for, Joe, where people can, when they do have a situation, disaster or a surge come in from an incident to a facility or to the organization, they can say, wow, this was like we trained. And that's something I know you all strive for at Paragon.
Well, you're exactly right, Jamie. And I mean, I was listening to both Dan and Nick, you know, those are the guys that we pull from and use as our instructors, because they have lived it and they understand it is, and they understand relevance of it all. They have the experience to the students' experience as real as we know how to make it. So, I encourage folks to reach out to us, knowing that guys like Nick and Dan will be amongst our instructor pool, and talk to us about how we can help you make your disaster educational experience as good as it can possibly be.
And where could folks find you? Where's the best way to for them to reach out and have that consultation and find out exactly what you can do for them?
So we would certainly encourage folks to call us or contact us via email. You can do that through the Disaster Podcast website, but you can also do that with us directly at ParagonMedicalEducationGroup.com. We have a Facebook page, Paragon Medical Education Group, as well. So we welcome any contacts through any of those sources to help us get your training rolling.
Excellent. And Joe, as always, we thank you for your continued support to help us bring the Disaster Podcast to our audience. And as a matter of fact, you know, I just wanted to remind people that they can reach out to us and join our Facebook group, which is continuing to grow, continuing to be more and more active. And Nick and Dan, if you are active on social media and on Facebook, we'd love to have you become part of that community if you aren't already, by just searching for Disaster Podcasts and asking to join the group. We love getting questions there. We love people that post articles and pose questions there. So we hope that everybody will continue to do that, and you guys included.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm already a part of the group, so I'm looking forward to being more active.
Well, excellent. And like I said, we'll be posting this episode there. And if anyone out there listening has a specific question or a comment they'd like to pose, we'll make sure we get the answers there for you in the group. So you can go ahead and do that. Sam, where can folks find you?
Mute button. In the usual social media places under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, certainly in the Disaster Podcast group on Facebook, as you said, is growing, and also on the disasterpodcast.com website. What about you, Jamie?
Well, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media locations. I always urge people to friend, follow, or otherwise catch up with me there. And always over at disasterpodcast.com and in our Facebook group, as I said earlier. It's always great to reach out to folks and to bring the discussion together so that, you know, the lessons like we've discussed tonight, the incredible situations, the questions that have been raised, we can continue the discussion. And hopefully, you know, through that, we will find other people's reactions to that. So I just want to thank everybody for checking that out. And Sam, you know, we've had some really amazing things come up in this episode that have pointed out so much about what we talk about every week in disaster medicine.
Yeah, I can't believe how much information was imparted in these episodes. So thanks so much to you guys for being here. And we will definitely have another podcast about disaster medical education, because that's a topic we haven't covered nearly as much. But for now, we can say disaster medicine is not our everyday medicine.